we can't be too afraid of making mistakes, because it's really difficult to learn and be able to have a spontaneous relationship with a client. It's difficult if we're too hung up. We've got to be able to be somewhat relaxed and be ourselves and make mistakes and apologize and learn more.
In this interview, I'm joined by Dr. Luis Cozzolino, a clinical psychologist, author, and professor based in Beverly Hills, California. He received his PhD in clinical psychology from UCLA and an MTS from Harvard University. He's been professor at Pepperdine since 1986 and lectures around the world on psychotherapy, neuroscience, trauma, and attachment. Dr. Cozzolino has authored 10 books, including The Neuroscience of Psychotherapy, Attachment-Based Teaching, and The Making of a Therapist, which is the focus of this conversation. You'll learn how Lou would approach his education and training if he was starting again from scratch, the most common mistakes therapists tend to make and how to avoid them, what Dr. Cozzolino learned from being a direct student of Carl Rogers in the 1970s, the value of embracing confusion and complexity in psychotherapy, and more. You can learn more about Lou's work by visiting drloucozzolino.com. Okay, Lou, welcome to the show. To get started, could you maybe tell us about why you initially decided to become a therapist?
Probably pretty much the same as most other people. You know, we're concerned that we're crazy. We have emotions that we can't control. We have weird relationships and dysfunctional families. And so my hope was that I could figure it out and maybe have a good life if I could understand what was going on with me and the people around me.
That's a good reason, I suppose. Now, can you tell me about your experiences learning from Carl Rogers in the 1970s and how these impacted you?
Sure. I mean, I think before I was involved in that stage of my training, and actually that was my first real encounter with real psychotherapy training. And I think that I had been sort of more influenced by the human potential movement of the 60s and early 70s. And so I think I was a bit of I think I fell into the realm of the kind of narcissistic cult leader who wanted to change people's minds and make them happy and help them have insights and all of that stuff. And I was never really quite comfortable with it, even though that was the model I was presented with and it fit my defenses. On the other hand, it didn't really fit. It felt deeply wrong. I didn't know why at the time. I just had the intuition that, therapy as a therapist, as warrior, was not quite where I wanted to go.
Interesting. And how long before that therapist as warrior part of you went away? Does it still remain, or how long before that sort of faded into the background?
I think it shifted. I think therapist as warrior, that went away probably over a few years. Didn't take that long. I think where I've remained a warrior, I've sort of channeled that part of me into more of the sort of the scientific, intellectual, academic aspects of psychotherapy. And so the fights I have now are not with clients. They're more with other therapists who think they know everything because they've done a training in EMDR or something like that.
So it's been a bit to good use then. So can you tell me about the importance of therapy as something that you do with someone as opposed to something you do to someone?
All right. Well, I think, going back to, that's a great question, connecting my experience with Rogers, was that he was the first person I had met that really engaged with clients as a human being. And you just got the sense of his presence and his vulnerability, his availability. And I guess I had these two reactions. One was, this attitude isn't necessarily sort of satisfying my grandiosity. On the other hand, I see that this is exactly what I need in order. Like, I don't need someone else to give me a new language so I can reinforce my defenses with it. I really need to have somebody who is kind of the human I always needed in my life, who knew how to listen and could think and could give me valuable input. So I think that that was sort of the origin of that sense that I have of that, you know, every research, every therapeutic relationship being kind of an experiment of nature, and the therapist and the client get together and discover who they are in that relationship. And hopefully the therapist has something to add, something additional that will allow the relationship to be nurturing to the client. But very often the relationships are nurturing to the therapist as well. So it's a mutual process, even though the relationship is somewhat non-reciprocal. The process is a life experience for both therapist and client.
So even though it wasn't what you were hoping to, I suppose, find whenever you're in the early stages of learning about therapy, you know, whenever you were quite, had this therapist's warrior mindset, part of you on an unconscious level recognized that this would be good for you, or that you sort of, this would be good for your development. Like, is that fair to say?
Yeah, I had the intuition that it was important for me. I didn't understand why, because I didn't know enough yet intellectually to really make a case for it. But most people in their 20s, I was soaking in my defenses. And so there were things that I needed to face that I was afraid to face, but intuitively I kind of knew that I was keeping important work at bay. And so that was a big part of it for me.
Interesting. Okay, so if you had a time machine, Lou, and you could go back to before you trained, knowing what you now know, and your aim was to be the best therapist that you could be, how would you approach your education and your training?
Probably, if I had the resources, I didn't have much financial resources when I started all of this, but I would think that if I did, what I would have wanted to do would have been to spend a few years in therapy before I even started training, to kind of disambiguate the part of me that needed therapy and the part of me that wanted to do therapy, you know. So I think that's the only thing that I would have trained. Other than that, I've been pretty happy with my training. I mean, what I've done, my strategy has always been to take on the most difficult challenges I could, because I didn't want to be insecure about my training. Right. I may not. I realize I'm probably wrong as much as I am right, and I make a lot of mistakes, but I didn't want to be insecure about the quality of my training. So I think both the psychotherapy training over many years, and also all of, you know, the even writing books, I think for me is part of my education. It's always pushing myself to learn more and to risk going out on a limb, developing theories, and, you know, sort of risking also the feedback that people give you, because no matter what you do, everyone has something to say about it. And you've got to be willing, you've got to sort of have the ego strength to tolerate feedback.
Interesting. So your basic mindset was always seeking out the most difficult training or challenge or task that you could do. And then because you sort of took that on, it meant you were more secure about your own education and your ability to contribute and help others.
Well, I think I was more secure about my training. The question of whether my training, you know, getting the best training is one thing. Whether the training is actually any good or applicable is another thing. Because you can get really great training in something that doesn't apply to different situations. But sometimes if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So I see people who are, you know, very well trained in one specific field, and they just assume that that's going to work for any client. And having been trained in psychodynamic theory and CBT family systems and a variety, EMDR and a variety of other styles of therapy, it was clear to me that every perspective misses a whole bunch of other information, right? In other words, how the framework with which you approach the psychotherapy creates a foundation and gives you a structure, but it also omits and limits a whole bunch of things that need to be considered. So I've always wanted, I never wanted to become a devotee in a cult. But I, even though all of, the going through school, all of my teachers wanted to indoctrinate me and, create a mini them. But I resisted that. I think one of the lures of neuroscience for me was that, we all have a brain, and the principles of how the brain work is common across any sort of conceptual, created, fictional, whatever fiction a psychotherapist makes about the unconscious, the brain is still there. So the principles of plasticity and neural dynamics and integration, no matter what perspective you work from, those are the things you have to influence. So if you start from there and work your way up conceptually to different theories, I just felt more confident in being able to synthesize these different perspectives that I had been learning.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, I've heard you say elsewhere that the simplest things are the deepest things. I think it's like a Buddhist quote or something. What would you say are the non-negotiable foundational elements that every therapist should be learning early on? Like the real important stuff.
Yeah, well, I would say that the number one thing is probably has to do with transference and countertransference. And that has to, and I think what I hear in schools or what I hear from students taking classes is that they're being told that countertransference is bad. And so they're trying to do therapy without countertransference, which is essentially impossible. So they're being taught to engage in a behavior that they can't possibly succeed in, right? So I think I would say one of the non-negotiables is realizing that you're creating the experience of the therapy along with your patient. Your patients are not samples in some kind of a petri dish that you're keeping alive artificially, right? They're full people with full lives. And as you're getting to know them, as you're developing a relationship, that relationship is full of your projections, right? And just like when you date someone, you go out on a first date. After that first date, if you had a good time, your brain goes crazy, projecting into the future and who they are and all of that. And then when you're getting to know someone, you learn who they really are as opposed to who you thought they were, right? And that's just a basic principle of the way our brains and our minds organize, organize reality. It goes back to Freud's projective hypothesis, are like nature abhors a vacuum. Human beings abhor, ignorance, and it makes them anxious. And so what we do is we develop all sorts of ideas about people, even before we meet them. And I think a lot of the process of therapy as a therapist is being smart enough to realize that and slowly deconstruct what your projections create so that you can get to know the person you're sitting across from. Because the better you know them, I think the better able you are to help them.
Very interesting. What are some of the biggest mistakes you made early on in your career that would be wise for beginning therapists now to avoid? Or if none come to mind, common mistakes you see in the people that you teach or supervise when they're getting started in their careers?
God, so many mistakes. I mean, that whole The Making of a Therapist, that book that I wrote, is chock full of the mistakes that I've made. I think, one of the first one that comes to mind is the kind of Eurocentric arrogance we have about how our ideas and our methods and techniques are applicable to other cultures. And as time has gone on, I've gotten more and more clear about how Eurocentric psychotherapy is, and our notion of individuality and authenticity and separateness and all of those ideas are so culturally relative. And they're really the sort of the soup in which psychotherapy developed. And so I think one of the mistakes I made often at the beginning was projecting my values onto other people and not putting the time in to learn more about their values. And then, in a sense, questioning myself about whether what I was doing was actually helpful or made sense to who they are. Right. I think also, too, at the beginning, I thought I could know culture. I would take these cultural seminars, but I ended up just learning a lot of stereotypes for people that defy stereotypes. You know, so what I've learned is that you have some demographic information about someone, but people are so damn heterogeneous that no matter what information you have, it can trigger all sorts of associations in our minds that are irrelevant. And so I kind of gave up trying to understand culture because it's too heterogeneous, and I just try to understand individuals. And that seems to have served me pretty well in my career. People seem to appreciate the fact that I don't assume that they do anything because they're a certain gender or color or race or nationality. It's like, teach me who you are. Share yourself with me and let me learn as much as I can about you. And very tentatively then will I add my two cents once I feel like I have some comfort in even having the beginning grasps of who you are.
Sounds almost like a beginner's mindset. Every time you meet, you're working with a client in therapy, you've kind of got that blank slate almost, you know. That's I can't see that. I can't see anybody going too far wrong with that approach. Now, I've heard like quite a few of my friends are therapists, and I've heard it can be quite an isolating profession. How can someone avoid isolation as a therapist?
It's really hard. It's hard, especially if you only do private practice. I would say the best, of course, you have to keep investing in your own personal life. The problem is, I mean, I had, there were years where I worked so hard and spent all day with people. The last thing I wanted to do was socialize, right? So I think there's a, doing full-time psychotherapy isn't really that viable if you want to have a real life, okay? And so I always suggest everyone consider figuring out two or three different types of jobs, right, including psychotherapy, but being able maybe to work in community centers or in a clinic or, you know, working in places where you're engaged with other people and where also you can develop relationships that aren't necessarily, you know, unilateral.
That is, sounds like there's a lot of wisdom in that. Now, you mentioned earlier that, you know, if you were going back to before you began, what you would do differently is that you would spend more time in therapy yourself before you started training. Can you tell me about the importance of therapists being in therapy themselves and why this is so vital?
Well, you know, the fact that you have to ask that question, right, is it really shows where the field has gone. Because at the beginning, the assumption was there was no way you could do therapy if you hadn't been in therapy for 5 or 6 years, right? And as more and more places began to sell degrees, you know, with very little quality control, they stopped expecting people to be in therapy because they would lose tuition dollars that way. And so the requirements for getting into a program, graduating from the program, getting licensed, all of those things have been eroded, you know, over the past, at least during my career, over the past 40 years. It used to be hard to get into a program to study psychotherapy, you know, and now as long as your check doesn't bounce, you can find a program for yourself. And so psychotherapy really it's probably the primary learning experience in being a therapist. In other words, it's in observing a therapist doing their work, but also observing the internal, sort of changes and the morphing and the evolution and development and all of those things inside of yourself, where you can really learn from the inside out the process of going through that very complex sort of rewiring process. And so you can read about it in books, but, you know, reading about a lot of things in books isn't the same as experiencing it. And so I would say, I mean, I really don't consider people therapists if they haven't been through therapy. I mean, they're students, right? You know, you've taken courses in therapy, you might have done some therapy, but you're flying on instruments in the fog if you haven't been in therapy yourself.
That makes a lot of sense. I've heard you say elsewhere that therapists are often the hardest clients to treat. Why do you think that is?
Well, primarily because as children, people that tend to want to grow up to be therapists are the person is the person in their family that doesn't usually get the care they need. So they convert their personality and their sense of identity, not from being someone who has a reciprocal relationship, but someone who takes care of a parent with an addiction or a problem or some psychological stress. Or often, many people in my class consistently, they'll have a sibling with a mental disorder or a physical problem. And so very early on in life, I think therapists learn that help is not for them. Help is for other people, and their job is to provide it. But most of the therapists I know are deeply pessimistic about the value of therapy, which is one of the reasons why going through it and having a positive experience will allow you to have a different stance towards therapy. The problem is lots of therapists, especially in school, when they're in school, they can't afford to see an experienced therapist. So they go to someone, you know, that's just learning how to practice, and then they end up having a boyfriend or a girlfriend, you know, that they pay to talk to. But they think they've had the experience of therapy, but they really haven't. I mean, experience matters in psychotherapy.
Interesting. So I want to talk now about the value of ignorance and confusion in therapy. How can confusion be useful in therapy?
Well, you probably have had this experience yourself. People with a lot of certainty generally are not that well either educated or not that intelligent, right? The more you know, the more confused you get. And I think what happens in therapy, especially with young therapists, is that you feel incredibly insecure about doing this thing that you take seriously and feel is important. And so you're never told it's okay to be confused or not know what you're doing. You're sort of expected to be an expert from the beginning, having never done it before, right? And so what people do is they kind of develop a false therapist personality, right? That makes them feel or look superficially deep, but it also makes them deeply superficial because they can't go very far off that platform that they've sort of imagined for themselves.
That makes sense. Now, you talk in the book about being a good enough therapist, sort of tied with Winnicott's notion of a good enough mother. What does that mean in this context?
Well, I think it means that we can't be too afraid of making mistakes, because it's really difficult to learn and be able to have a spontaneous relationship with a client. It's difficult if we're too hung up. We've got to be able to be somewhat relaxed and be ourselves and make mistakes and apologize and learn more. You know, but I think what a lot of people do is they kind of hold back because they don't want to say the wrong thing. And a lot of times we only know what the wrong thing, we know the wrong things to say, but we don't know what the right things are to say. So we keep quiet. And that's a better approach other than saying stupid things, but also that has to be balanced with a kind of freedom and relaxation, you know, and openness to being curious or confused. Or when a client asks you a question, say, that's a great question. I couldn't begin. And Rogers used to do all the time. People would ask him, you know, what should I do? And he said, I wouldn't even begin to imagine I'd know the answer to that question, right? What I'm willing to do is be here with you and try to figure it out together. But that answer for this is going to come from you, not from me. Right. So it's that kind of, I guess it's like humility, modesty, openness, and not having to be the expert. I hate experts.
I really value whenever someone just says, like, I don't know. Like, I actually find this quite rare. I used to have a friend, and no matter what the question was, if he had no idea what he was talking about, he would give a big elaborate explanation of whatever the thing was. And it was just like, man, just, you don't know. It's okay. You know? What's the biggest thing you've changed your mind on over the years in this field, Lou? Anything you've had a major sort of change of direction in your work?
Yeah, I don't know if it's sort of a professional issue. It was more of a personal issue. I think, you know, as a kid, I spent a lot of time on my own, a lot of time reading, a lot of time introspecting and you know, just thinking about life and thinking about other people and the universe and the like. And so when I grew up, I kind of thought that everybody did that, like that everybody was reflective and had an inner world and a sense of who they were separate from the external environment. And it probably took me well into my 30s and maybe even longer to realize that I'm interacting with quite a number of people that have no sense of an inner world, right? They have no clue about themselves as separate from the environment. Part of that is cultural. Like I said, you know, because I did a lot of martial arts, I spent a lot of time with people from Japan specifically. And now I have, you know, every year, scores of students from China and Korea. So I'm learning more about the differences across culture in sort of in the individual versus communal perspective and how that shapes our psyche. But even in the West, just limiting ourselves to people, you know, sort of Europe, America, Australia, you know, the kind of places where we've got a similar perspectives despite different cultures. I'm just always surprised to see that that's optional. In other words, like people can grow up and they can be quite successful and do quite well without an inner world. And it's, you know, so they come into therapy and then I have to kind of learn, well, what am I working with and how can I work with them? Do I need to be simply or strictly behavioral or strictly cognitive or, you know, what's their, I wouldn't say that it's a love language, but, you know, what language are they dealing, you know, do they interpret the world through? And so that was something I would say that's considerably different now for me than early on.
That's really interesting. And, you know, I can see that that could save a lot of going down a lot of blind alleys in therapy. If you know the basic language or the basic frameworks through which somebody looks at the world, if you figure that out early on, then you can speak to them in that language and you're far more likely to get through as opposed to speaking something that they don't really understand.
Yeah, I think I assumptions and projection, I didn't do this because of, I don't think it was hubris. I think it really was a general assumption that I wasn't very different from other people. So if I saw the world in a certain way or had a certain way of dealing with things, that of course other people could do it. I didn't think I was special in that way. But it was learning not only how I'm special, but how everyone is special and how everyone constructs their identity and their relationship with the world, other people, the physical plan, all of those things. People construct quite different realities for themselves. And just learning what those realities are is fascinating in and of itself, but it certainly does give you leverage as a therapist.
For sure. Now, I'm reading your book on Kindle, and one of the most highlighted passages, I'm just going to read this out for you here. Your goal is not to be right. It is to help your client move in the direction of psychological health. Being right is far less important than being caring, empathic, and available. So can you expand on the importance of just letting go of this need that we all seem to have about being right, whether it's in relationships or therapy or whatever?
It's a real challenge. I think we go through school and we have tests and we get right answers and wrong answers. You know, we compete with each other for being correct or being smarter and all of this stuff. The whole world seems to be set up that way. But when you're dealing with a client who has their own defenses and needs and they're at a certain place in their development, all of those different things, you might have high probability of being correct when you say something to a client. But if they don't understand it or they can't hear it or they're not ready to get it, And, you know, like, you know, one of the things I did at the beginning of my career was I would sort of like get on a tear and like try to talk the client, you know, into what I was saying. If you knew this, your life would be a lot better. And so I think I've backed off a lot from that. And if I present something that a client doesn't accept or doesn't understand, or it's like, okay, let's move on. It doesn't mean I'm not right, but it doesn't mean I am right. It doesn't mean anything. It's just part, it's that experiment of that particular day to see what was going on. And I've had clients who, you know, I'll say something, it's completely rejected. 3 or 4 weeks later, they come in and it's their idea, right? They came up with it, right? So for some people, they really can't accept input from other people, especially if they grew up in families where people really didn't have their best interest at heart. So they have to protect themselves from input from others, right? So sometimes clients won't give me the satisfaction of ever telling me that I've told them anything correct. But I notice over time, they take it, they plagiarize it, they reword it, and they express it as their own. And that's fine with me, right? That's fine. But at the beginning, I think I wanted more credit. You know, I want credit for this, damn it.
It reminds me, actually, I remember reading Steve Jobs' biography by Walter Isaacson like years ago. And what would always happen with him is somebody in the company would come to him with an idea for a new product or some innovation. And he would just say, that is the stupidest thing I have ever heard. Like, get out of my sight.
Yep.
And then like two months later, he would run in somewhere and say, I've got this great idea. And it would be the exact same idea that somebody else brought to him. But he had just found a way to and was probably unconscious of it too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, talk about ego. He had one.
For sure. Now, as well, a big part of your book is about this idea of making good mistakes. So what does this mean? And there's an example you have in the book. I'm not sure if you remember this or not, because I know you wrote the book quite a while ago. But you talk about witnessing a very horrific car accident. And then you went in to do therapy after, and this had really impacted the session. But then you managed to turn it into a good mistake. So maybe if you could tell us about what happened there and how this all links in.
Yeah, I mean, I think I had this experience of you know, being right next to a few people being killed, and it was really shocking and very disorienting. And my usual, you know, my standard approach to sort of survival, coming down from my two construction working, you know, my father and my grandfather, was, you know, move on, you know, pull up your big boy pants and move on. And so I went and I was working that night with a particularly difficult client. And it was only after the session that was really that I, you know, I was quite off during that session and not sensitive at all enough to his very fragile ego and his, you know, he was a Hollywood type. So you have to be careful with these successful Hollywood people. And so it was clear to me, it wasn't clear to me until after the session. It was like, holy shit, I was so preoccupied and so aroused from what had happened earlier in the day, and just sort of repressed it or made believe it wasn't a problem. And just sort of realized that, went through it, and ended up calling him and apologizing and saying, listen, I did a really dumb thing. You know, I should have called off the session, because if I was aware of what was going on with me, I would have just, I don't know, called friends, gone to a bar, taken the day off. I don't know, whatever you do when you're like too upset to work. But I wasn't smart enough to do that on that day, right? So I apologized. I didn't charge him for the session. I mean, not that that means very much, but it was just a gesture to say, you know, here, you did not get your money's worth during the session. Plus, you got some negative stuff from me. And I'm sorry about that. And I think what that did, and he was someone who had a very authoritarian father who never apologized for anything. And so that was that moved us to another level. The bad session was more of a blip on his radar, but my apology meant so much more to him. right? And that deepened our relationship in a way that was more important. And so when I talk about making good mistakes, that's what I mean. It's like we're inevitably going to make mistakes. We're human. We've got lots of things going on. We get sick. We get tired. We have children. They keep us up all night. There's all kinds of things that happen in life. So we're not always on our game. But if you're not on your game, or if you're on your game and you just make a mistake, the ability to figure out how that mistake fits into the defenses and the psyche of your client, and then how can you use that mistake to move towards repair, right? When you think about the attachment theorists, it's, they have a nice model. It's like the way we learn to be secure in relationships is being regulated, dysregulated, and then re-regulated, right? So we go from being connected, disconnected, and reconnected. And so therapy needs to have the space for that. It isn't all about, oh, you're the best therapist in the world. Oh, you're my favorite client. Oh, good. You know, you've got to have ruptures and you have to have negative interactions too, because like Wilhelm Reich said, you know, beneath every positive transference lurks a negative one. You know, we don't build defenses because we have good experiences. We build defenses because we've been hurt or, you know, in some way.
I think it's incredibly valuable, not even just in therapeutic relationships, but just in human relationships in general. Like if you are in a relationship with someone and there's a rupture, like just figuring out what your responsibility is in the whatever caused that, and then communicating that to the other person, can I think it can just really, really strengthen relationships. It happened to me with a friend recently. Like I won't get into details, but we fell out and I just was like, right, I really messed up here, and I apologize and all the rest. And then she was telling me like a couple of weeks after, she was like crying. She's like, look, no one's ever done that for me before. Like that was really, you know, that really moved me. Like she really appreciated it, you know? So I just think there's a lot of value in it, and there's rupture and repairs. And
well, but isn't it crazy? I mean, we all screw up every day. And the fact that the apologizing is such a unique and memorable experience is really unfortunate.
For sure, for sure. No one likes to do it. We've got like a resistance against doing it. So another really big concept in the book is this idea of shuttling. And what is shuttling, and why is this so effective?
Yeah, I think the, and you know, for me, at the beginning, psychotherapy was such an intellectual, academic, it was kind of like a research project. Every session, every client, you know, was all of that. And I think that when you're in your own head, you're kind of separate from the client, and you're also separate from your body. And so one of my therapists years ago used that word, and I picked up on it and used it ever since. And it really, shuttling is remembering when you're thinking to check in with your body to see what you're feeling and what's going on inside of you, right? So as to stay light on your feet. You know, you think like a footballer. A footballer that's flat-footed is probably not going to be very good, you know, at the sport. So you have to be on your toes. Whenever you're up, you have to remember to go down, and vice versa. So that kind of, there's sort of a mind-body integration that can occur that way. And then the other form of shuttling is horizontal, right? It's to your client and back. So taking time during the session to get out of your own head and just imagine hypothetically what it would be like to be your client sitting across from you sharing these things, and what sorts of reactions, you know, what kind of feelings you might have, what would be going on in your body if you were them, you know, and also what types of things might be helpful to hear and what things might not be helpful to hear. So it really is sort of just a consciousness expansion exercise, right? To get us out of our heads and out of our bodies or perspectives so that we can include these other aspects of our experience.
So a client will communicate something to you that on the surface level might sound, you know, okay, but then you'll check in with your body. And I think you say something about your chest or your stomach or it's a region. And then you'll maybe feel a sensation or an image will come to mind or whatever that really just doesn't add up with what they're saying. And then you'll communicate that back to them. And then something entirely new will emerge where they'll say, well, actually, I'm actually feeling this year and that was a bit of a front or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes it's them. Sometimes it's me. I never know. Right. I might check in and I might say, oh, God, I feel hungry. Or I'll check in with my client. Oh, they're hungry. Are they hungry or am I hungry? I don't know. It's a hypothesis. Right. I might look at a client and say, oh, my God, I get so much sadness. I'm getting all of this feeling of sadness from them. But are they sad or am I sad? So I think going back to your question about therapy, one of the reasons why personal therapy is so incredibly important is that it helps you to sort of explore the topography of your inner world so that you get a better sense of the types of things you're aware of and you're not aware of, right? Like one of the things I learned early on is that when I'm trying to cheer someone up, it means that I'm frightened. Because when I was a kid, my mother was depressed and that used to scare me. And I would try to do all sorts of things to, you know, get her active and moving, even if it was to chase after me, to, you know, throw something at me because I would curse or say something. But it wasn't because I wanted to do that. It was because I needed her to be activated so I could feel safer. Right. And so in the process of my own therapy, I learned, okay, if I'm sitting across from someone that's depressed, what that activates in me, especially if they're a younger woman around the age my mother was at that time, it creates fear in me, right? And I don't want to treat my client from the perspective of my being afraid. I'm going to treat my client from the perspective of empathy about their depression, you know? So I need to be the adult and not the frightened child. And if you're not aware of those sorts of, you know, those paintings that hang on the wall inside of your head, you'll just go for it. You'll assume that what you're creating is about your client as opposed to being about you.
How do you know, how do you tell what you should communicate and maybe what you should hold back on? Is it just something you learn over time? Like, how do you figure that out yourself?
I mean, I think it's a lot of it is trial and error because usually every couple of weeks, I'll feel spontaneously like I should say something that comes to mind. And then I take a step. I think about it, right? And I go through sort of the algorithm in my head. It's like, what are the contraindications of this, right? So I try never to blurt anything out, especially if it's a little bit risky or edgy. And, you know, that's it. And then it's just trial and error learning. And then you got to be willing to apologize for those things too, if they're wrong.
For sure.
Yeah.
We had a talk from a guy in the UK called Jeremy Holmes. He publishes a lot on attachment and psychotherapy. And one of the things he talks about here is that whenever a therapist does this, whenever they communicate, like say the client says something to them that brings up an image for them, and then you just freely communicate what that brings up for you, it almost is like the therapist sort of serves as a model for that the client can then see, okay, so they're just communicating what's happening in their inner experience. And then the client then benefits from that as well, because it leads to them sort of practicing a similar thing. Do you think that happens too? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, it's possible. I mean, with any given thing you're sharing, it could be about your client. It could be about you. If it's about you, it doesn't mean your client can't learn from it. You know what I'm saying? So it's really, there are very few rules that I follow anymore. You know what I mean? I follow rules related to boundary and finances and those sorts of things. But when it comes to the actual, like what would be helpful to someone, I've been able to help people in ways that would have never, you know, that would have never been taught in school, yet they were incredibly successful in therapy. And so, and vice versa, I've done things with people that I was taught to do that were horrible. And so it's really just a matter of trial and error learning. And I guess what we call intuition is probably just the accumulated memory of a variety of experiences that hopefully allow us to have a higher probability of success. You know, we may not be aware of why we're choosing to do something, but still it can work more with more experience.
Yeah, definitely. Now, you give a really good metaphor in the book about being tied to the mast. So can you maybe tell us about this metaphor and its relevance for therapy? And I'll just read a quote here. Clients come with well-practiced relational patterns and will tempt you into playing a role in their drama. So how can this tying to the mask thing help with that?
Yeah. Well, for example, there are clients that are raised to be dependent, and they'll do everything to get you to take care of them, to like take in and be responsible for them. And I've got a very strong urge to take care of things. You know, like I don't let puppies run away. You know, if they don't have a tag on, I've got to do something about it. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I'm not indifferent. So if somebody's in trouble or distressed, I'm on the case. That's my, that's probably similar to you. It's hard for you to let something bad happen and not feel like you have some responsibility for it. So for me, I have to remember, I have to tie myself to the mask so that I don't try to rescue someone or save them. Right. So I've got all of those impulses to do it, but it's better for the client if I don't. And I use that metaphor from Ulysses, you know, going past the islands of the sirens. And you know that those sirens have a strong call and the flesh is weak. So tie me to the mast as we go by that island.
Yeah, a lot of wisdom in that. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about the paradox of client resistance in therapy, and why is like learning to work with and work through it so important?
Yeah, well, I mean, from my perspective, the thing that differentiates therapy primarily from friendship, right? The primary difference is that pretty much your friends, for the most part, accept your act. Like the deal in relationship is you don't call me on my act and I won't call you on your act. And we'll just have a good time together. We'll hang out, right? But in therapy, you come because your life isn't working in some way. And it's usually not working in some way because you've got a habit pattern that is, you know, sort of dysfunctional. You have a set of beliefs that that you have that you hold on to that don't work for you. You know, a whole variety of things. And so I think the important thing is being to realize that the resistance that someone has in therapy, that's really where the gold is in therapy, right? The difference between a therapist and a buddy is that the therapist is focused on resistance and trained to deal with it, right? So we look at, whatever we're dealing with, it's not just the words that our client is saying that we need to attend to. It's also their manner of being, the way they live their lives, the way they have their relationship with us, right? And so you'll see that the clients will say they understand something, but then the next sentence, they'll say something that contradicts that understanding. So these old ways of protecting ourselves and regulating our anxiety are woven into thousands of different behaviors and thoughts and feelings and all of that. And it's working with that resistance that really gives the client more information about themselves. If you're not doing that, you're doing counseling. Counseling is where you give people information so they can make better decisions. Therapy should be something where you're helping people to learn more about themselves so they can make better decisions on their own.
Right. Interesting. Now, I've recently started therapy myself, and, you know, when you're starting off, it's scary. You know, it's scary when you're starting therapy. And what advice do you have for therapists to sort of help clients ease into the process and maybe take down some of their defense, not take down your defenses, but maybe lower their defenses slightly?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, again, the way I do that is presenting myself as another human being, doing my best to try to make it through the day, right? And I've had a lot of struggles. I've failed a lot. I've made a lot of mistakes. I've done some things that were good, and share that I've got lots of ideas and suggestions and all sorts of ways of working. I never know if I'm right. You know, we have to decide together whether something that I say hits you in a way that makes sense that you can work with. So you don't have to worry about being a good client. You can't help but be a good client. You just have to relax and be yourself. And it's my job and then our job to take whatever you bring in and see if we can learn anything from it.
For sure. And how would you confront a client? Like, say you know they've got defenses up. How might you go about confronting them? And in the book, again, another metaphor is Aikido. You talk about how Aikido is a good sort of metaphor for this.
Yeah. Well, there are so many different defenses. It's hard to give a particular answer, you know, about defenses in general. But the thing that I can say that's a more general principle that works probably the majority of the time is to never meet their resistance with your resistance, right? To accept whatever defenses they have, because most people's defenses were born during childhood and they were created for survival purposes. So people need those defenses, or at least they needed them. Usually the problem is, you know, we grow up in some type, in one type of family, and then we go out into a world and the conditions are different. The people are different. You know, what we want is different. And but the problem is unconsciously we're still dealing with these old thought and behavioral and emotional patterns. So what we try to do in a sense unconsciously is recreate the relationships we're trying to avoid in the new relationships we develop. So people discover that they're in patterns of relationship. And usually people say, my God, I had a woman come and say, God, the last five guys I've dated have just been horrible. And I woke up the other day and I realized the common element is me. Right. And so then, so you go from a position of projecting to a position of openness and consideration. Well, am I doing anything to contribute to this? You know, how am I selecting? How am I interacting? How, you know, what are the things that I'm doing that's shaping someone else's behavior? So again, the client's job is to come in and seduce you into their family. And I don't mean that sexually. I just mean to get you to play the role, if it's a parent or a sibling or whatever it is. And then your job is to not comply, right? Their defenses are going to include getting you to move to a position that's comfortable for them. I've had clients come in during the first section and, you know, after a half an hour and ask me, well, when are we having sex? And I say, well, that's not on the agenda. But, you know, what makes you ask that question? And they said, well, I've had sex with all my clients so far. I mean, therapists so far. Right. So, again, you know, and usually those people were sexually abused as kids. And so you create these survival patterns and ways of being. And you have the unconscious assumption that's what you need to keep doing. And so our job, I think, as therapists is really to disappoint that manipulation, that unconscious manipulation, and give them a different experience. So if they're dependent, don't start taking care of them, right? If they don't expect to be taken care of, go out of your way to signal warmth and to, you know, to maybe text them between sessions and check in and see how they're doing, right? You want to really disappoint their expectations and defenses so you can establish a different relationship with them.
Sure, for sure. Now, you've got a whole section on the book on sexual attraction in therapy. And this is a very important subject, because if it's not taken seriously, people could ruin lives, ruin careers, et cetera, et cetera. So what are your thoughts there on how to navigate this in therapeutic practice?
Well, I think the first principle is don't think you're above being sexually attracted to a client, and don't think that a client is not going to be sexually attractive to you. In other words, make that conscious, bring that into your supervision, bring that into your therapy, be honest with yourself, right? And there are going to be times in your life when you're hurt, you're lonely, you're exhausted, and you have a client in your office that you look forward to seeing, that you start fantasizing about, whatever, right? The important thing is, you know, when you feel that happening, you're not going to be able to handle it necessarily by yourself. So you have to have the courage to call a friend and say, you know, help, you know, talk to me, talk through this. Like I need to be reminded that this regression that I'm going through is not real. It's not part of my job, and it's not something that's good for either of us. So please, and if I can't talk myself out of it, come over, throw me in the trunk of your car, and wait till the client forgets about me before you let me out, right? But I think
that's
the problem, is thinking we're above these things, right? We've got to realize that we're always vulnerable. In fact, the person that lost their license when I was in graduate school was the ethics teacher. So none of us are above it. You know, none of us above the law of human attraction.
It's you hear lots of stories about spiritual gurus and all the rest, yogis like abusing their power because they probably get this stage to think I'm above these sort of temptations. Yeah. And then that's when you're most vulnerable.
Sure. Yeah. Ministers, priests, right? Without altar boys and with parishioners. And then you've got all sorts of people that maybe not sexual, but it might be, you know, physical abuse or emotional abuse. We, you know, none of us are above that sadistic, narcissistic part of ourselves. We all have it. For some of us, it's buried far deeper than for others. But you have to just acknowledge that you're a full human being with all of these things. And if you deny it, you're much more vulnerable to it.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. You mentioned earlier about regression. I was shocked in the book. You gave an example of you actually were in a therapy session and you experienced regression, and then you went to your car after and you forgot how to drive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So this is a powerful, powerful phenomenon. Can you maybe tell us a bit more like about how this works, regression? Like what's actually happening there?
Well, I think, you know, it's not really that occult. I think it's the activation of old powerful memories, right? And you know, like for example, when I was in EMDR, I was working on some memory from my childhood, and the memory was, and it was like a dream I had had repetitively. But when I walked into the house, there was this mirror that you would look into. There was like a little thing with a mirror and, you know, whatever, some fake flowers, that whole thing that people set up. And in this experience during ER, I walked in the house and I realized I couldn't see the mirror. But when I looked up, it was there. So I went into this memory much shorter than I had going back into that memory before. So I wasn't an adult thinking about it. I was actually experiencing it from the childhood perspective, right? So regression basically is the activation of early memories, and they're most helpful when they have to do with something that you've consciously repressed or forgotten or something that was traumatic for you.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, Lou, I think we'll wrap up there. I know you've got a client now on the hour, so I'll let you go, but it's been an absolute pleasure to reconnect with you and learn from you again. Where can people learn more about your work? Where can people get your books? Like where should people go after this conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I've got about a dozen different books on, you can get them all on Amazon. I suspect Amazon's available just about everywhere now. And so you've got that. I also have a website called drlucasolino.com, no periods in there. And you can see different pieces of my writing partners, a couple of colleagues that have built that website with me and who contribute as well. We're currently working on a book on executive functioning, which has been really interesting. And so that should be out sometime late next year or early 25. I just keep rolling forward. And if any of you, if you want to get in touch with me, you can contact me through the website.
Brilliant. Okay. Lou, thank you very much. And I want to wish you all the best going forward with all the work that you're doing.
Same to you. You take care.
Thank you for listening. And I hope you enjoyed the show. If you'd like to hear the full version, you can do so with the Weekend University Premium Membership. This gets you access to our master library of over 5 years of psychology conferences, including over 230 talks and interviews with the world's leading psychologists, professors, and authors, unlimited CPD certification, transcripts, quizzes, premium passes for our annual conference, online courses with Richard Schwartz and Deb Dana, and more. The cost is £97 for 1 year, which breaks down at around 27p per day. The best bit is you can try it out for 30 days completely risk-free, as all orders come with a 100% money-back guarantee. If you're interested, please go to twumembers.com for more information.